Today's episode of The Watch is brought to you by Microsoft Teams. Microsoft Teams is your hub for teamwork in Office 365 with so much to look after. Wouldn't it be great if there was just one place to look? Teams is that single workspace where you can work, share, and connect with people in your work life. Teams brings together your chats, meetings, files, and apps all in one place. And you can take teamwork where you work with apps for mobile and desktop. So whether you're sprinting towards a deadline or sharing your next big idea, Teams can help you and your team achieve even more. Microsoft Teams in Office 365. Visit office.com/teams to learn more. Today's episode of The Watch is brought to you by Universal Orlando Halloween Horror Nights. Universal Orlando Halloween Horror Nights brings together stories from the world's most notorious creators of horror. Select nights, September 14th through November 3rd in Universal Studios, Florida. Face terrifying haunted houses, including Netflix's Stranger Things and more. Plus, experience sinister scare zones, outrageous live shows, and some exhilarating Universal Studios attractions. Learn more at orlando.halloweenhorrornights.com/watch. That's orlando.halloweenhorrornights.com/watch. Hey guys, thanks for listening to The Watch. Andy and I talked about Solo, A Star Wars Story, and Killing Eve's second season finale. We have tons of content about both of these things on theringer.com. You can read Sean Fennessy's excellent piece on Solo from last week. Miles Suri and Justin Charity have also written really cool pieces, and Ben Lindbergh about Solo. That's all available on theringer.com. And as far as Killing Eve goes, Allison Herman and Lindsay Zolads have both written really excellent pieces on the first season. So you should check those out. Make sure you're listening to the Ringer Podcast Network. Sean did a pod last week with Shoemaker about Solo. Shoemaker also does Westworld The Recapables to keep you up to date on all the wild twists and turns of Westworld Season 2. Without further ado, Andy and I are about to get into the show.
I need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk now.
Hello, and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRinger.com, and joining me in the studio, falling short of box office predictions, it's Andy Greenwald!
Oh, I always fall short of expectations. That, you know, if you start with low expectations, you'll never disappoint anyone.
Yeah, they should have just made Solo a Star Wars story for, like, $10 million.
Yeah.
Then they'd be, like, caking up right now.
Star Wars, a Duplass Brothers story.
Andy, we are obviously going to be talking about Solo.
Hey, buddy. Happy Memorial Day weekend.
Oh, yeah.
To all our listeners.
Of course.
Tuesday show.
Long weekend of thinking about Solo. Some Solo thinking about Solo. Mm-hmm. And now we're going to talk about it as a duo. We'll talk about Solo. We'll talk about Killing Eve. Let's get right into it.
Because
There's two stories to talk about here. Or there's two things to talk about. We got to talk about our reaction to the film and our thoughts about the film itself. Just the text, bro.
Yeah.
New criticism.
Right.
And then we also have to talk about like the ramifications of this movie not living up to expectations financially and what it means for Star Wars Inc. going forward and whether or not we're going to keep getting 1 to 2 movies a year, whether they're going to dial back on the anthology stories, what it means for the Benioff, the Johnson trilogies, the Favreau TV show, any of that stuff. So let's just start with opening statements, I guess. Just kind of like riff on what you thought.
I thought Solo was a terrible movie. I saw it Friday. My reaction has calmed a little bit since then. Also, haven't slept too much. So you're not getting the... Chris got the full... We usually like to save reactions to the pod, but I saw Chris Friday night and I let him know.
Yeah.
I let him know some of my thoughts. I wish that we as a culture could have some reckonings about truth, objective truth in 2018.
Jeez.
I wish that that would apply to other topics than franchise films, but since it can't and won't, and that's not the purview of this podcast, let's just focus on Star Wars.
Okay.
The reviews of this movie are so backbreakingly charitable that it's insane to me. The argument that, oh, well, they were just having a good time. Don't you say that when we're just having a good time is the entire life attitude that got Lord and Miller fired off this film in the first place. This movie, to my eyes...
To be fair,
yes.
Can I jump in and just... It does sound like the reason that Lord and Miller were fired off this movie is because they were, like, not making the movie.
Sure.
They were just like, let's try that a different way. Why don't you wear a hat now? And like,
Can I make a suggestion?
Yeah.
Not making this movie would have been the right choice.
Then we can get to that.
I was shocked I was shocked by what a failure I thought this was on possibly every level. I thought it was borderline incompetent, basically. And I wonder how much of that incompetence, and I believe we'll talk about this going forward, is the fact that it was essentially one movie for a while, and then Ron Howard came in and reshot it as another movie. The movie he shot it as clearly is one that is more pleasing to shareholders, to franchise stewards, and the like. Uh-huh. But it is the least essential, most boring way of making a movie I could possibly imagine. Of all the things that we, and I don't just mean you and I mean people of our age group, I mean people who love Star Wars, I mean people who fell in love with this type of storytelling through the prism of the original trilogy. Of all the things that we would want from a movie about Han Solo, the original cool guy, funny guy, space smuggler.
You're looking at the original cool guy, well, my friend.
I mean, he had many children.
Sure.
Metaphorically speaking. The one child he had is Kylo Ren.
Damn.
I'm just saying. To make a movie which is just another earnest dude who has daddy issues and just wants to fly, man, and maybe help out. Origin stories are boring. Finding out this guy is actually good-hearted is boring.
That's the problem.
Especially when we already start with him as being good-hearted, especially when the whole point of A New Hope is that he has a good heart. We've already turned that card.
It is, sort of. That's where he ends up at the end of
A
New Hope. That's a kind of the essential misread that happened here, is that the origin story of Han Solo needs to end with him being a cynical shit.
Yeah.
Who will basically do anything for money and constantly is like breaking under the weight of debts that he owes various interstellar gamblers. And obviously they set up that life for him. But to make this movie and have it end in a place where he's like, we're all going to be okay. And like, he might help the rebellion. It's obvious that he's going to help the nascent rebellion.
Yes.
It's obvious that he may not have his girlfriend, but he's got some new best friends.
Yep.
That's not how this movie, like, that's not where he is at A New Hope. Now, they may have been trying to tease that out because they're like, let's make 3 Han Solo movies. Yes. But I think that was actually, I have a much larger thing to say about it, but I think that was one of the fundamental problems of this movie.
I agree. And you can look at it thematically as a failure, which I do. You can also just look at it as a series of very, very bad choices that collectively added up to a really, I'll say it again, I just think it's a bad movie. And I didn't expect that. I thought Sean Fennessy's piece on The Ringer, although I think he liked the film more than I did, is correct in that this is the first Star Wars movie that doesn't in any way feel special. It feels completely rote and mundane. 2 hours, 15 minutes. I mean, it just went on and on and on with a series of terrible plans and increasingly nonsensical character motivation. Okay, I'm going to step back for a second, let you have the floor, and then we can chop it up on a more specific basis. But man, you were serious about that?
So the initial idea behind these movies, from what I understand from reading way too many blog posts about these things and reading way too many interviews with Kathleen Kennedy and everybody else, is that they were supposed to be maybe not smaller in scope in terms of the special effects or in terms of what they were showing us, but they were supposed to be smaller stories. It's a Star Wars story. And that Rogue One making $1 billion, as Sean talked about in his piece, may have screwed that up a little bit. Because even though Rogue One had a slightly problematic production story, or at least a you know,
quite problematic,
like in terms of Gareth Edwards was more or less replaced by Tony Gilroy at a certain point, I think that its success showed that there is an unquenchable thirst for this stuff and that people are so excited to go to this world. Mm-hmm. And Rogue One actually was too big of a story. I mean, there was an epic war movie, essentially.
And then they put Darth Vader in it.
And then they put fucking Darth Vader in it. And that blew everybody's minds and maybe made them forget about some of the problems with Rogue One for the 2 hours leading up into that moment. Mm-hmm. So you have this idea that you can tell these small stories. There is a good movie inside of this movie.
Inside of Solo.
Yeah, and I think the thing that everybody was worried about, that Ehrenreich was going to be an absolute disaster, is not true. I actually thought he was fine. And here's why. Mm-hmm. Because he's one of the only two people who worked on this movie who seemingly made a choice. Okay, and the other one's Bradford Young. They had Bradford Young shoot this like he was Gordon Willis.
Young shot this?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, Bradford Young shot it in a very specific way, although at a certain point, I feel like they were like, brighten up the faces a little bit, bro. And then Ehrenreich actually like puts himself out there to make some choices about how he's going to try and capture one of like the five or six most iconic film characters of the post-World War II era, you know, like seriously. Mm-hmm. Everybody else here seems to be getting noted to death. And the script itself is not a story. They get story jammed so hard on this. And I don't even know, like, I don't know actually know how to quite to articulate this, but I can tell you the plot of A New Hope right now. Not because I've seen it 250 times, which I probably have, but because five things happen in that movie. They're on one planet. They escape. Mm-hmm. They go to another planet. It's not there. Mm-hmm. They get stuck on a space station. They get off and then they blow it up. Mm-hmm. That's the story.
Yep.
And that makes all the performances work because what people want and what they have to accomplish is clear. Mm-hmm. They go to three planets in 30 minutes in this movie. In the first 30 minutes, they're on three different planets. I can't remember the name of the last one. I have no idea whether or not, like, does Dryden Vos get to just jump to each planet? Does he have a home base? Like,
his all pleasure this stuff, yacht which goes is from like, one planet to another.
Where are we? Yeah. And how do you get there? And what are we doing? Is so muddled by, okay, well, we got to get this spice or the coaxium. But the thing is that when we get there, we're going to start a robot revolution. Mm-hmm. And also we're going to have a Wookiee reunion. Mm-hmm. And then there's going to be a really extended shootout, but all the people you're really worried about can't possibly die. Then we're going to get off the planet and we're going to do a black hole and a space monster and then a completely ridiculous MacGuffin science experiment involving making the Falcon faster. Mm-hmm. And then he's going to get out of there.
And then there's going to be a series of double and triple crosses that are actually single crosses because the movie can't commit to making anyone good or bad. And so everyone just ends up being fine.
Right. So I think that just clouds what is actually good about these movies, which is that even when they're ridiculous, the best moments of them, the best of these movies, and to my mind, that's A New Hope, Empire, yep. and frankly, The Last Jedi, mm-hmm. they have breathing room for people to have like moments, right? And the only real moments that are in this movie are the cape trying on scene.
Yep.
And like some of the Sabacc stuff, which I think also is just everybody working way too hard.
Yeah.
And
way too hard.
So you just get this movie that feels so compressed by, okay, we can't actually make a choice here. Nobody here wants to make a decision. Mm-hmm. So we're going to throw everything at it. And God forbid anybody in the audience ever be led anywhere where it actually is intellectually or emotionally stimulating. We're going to smash this score on top of you mm-hmm. so hard in every single frame that you never have an opportunity to have your own reaction to anything you're seeing on screen.
What was shocking to me, I agree with everything you just said. And what was shocking to me was the thing that I had heard, in as much as I have any connections at all to the film industry, which I don't, mm-hmm. but the things that I had heard was that the Kasdan father-son, Lawrence Kasdan and one of his sons, I'm forgetting which
John.
Son, Jonathan Kasdan, wrote the script. I heard the one thing that was going to save this movie through multiple directors was the script. Now, we don't know who else touched the script. We don't know what was done with the script.
This was, at various points, had been reported that people who had read this script said it was the best Star Wars script ever written.
Yes, standalone, like this was it.
Yeah.
And it would be almost impossible to screw up. Well, congratulations, Kathy Kennedy and company, you did.
Right.
But I question that because the opening scene in Corellia with the devious worm who can't be in
Lady
sunlight.
Lady Proxima, yeah.
What was any of that? I mean, the dialogue they're
saying.
Nobody
had ever thought to throw a rock through a window on these guys.
But also like, let's get a spaceship and get out of here. We'll just be together. I mean, what are we doing, guys? Is this
Born
to Run?
Yeah, Han is essentially, a Springsteen character.
But that's not interesting. And your point about there being something compelling in here is right. And the fact that they didn't even see it speaks to the disastrous production path that these movies are all set on. What is interesting to me, okay, the Kessel Run, that's the thing from his past that is of interest. We've heard about it. I wonder what that means. I wonder what that could be. Okay, great. They get this coaxium that is highly unstable, we're told, and they have to take it from one place to another place in an amount of time that is impossible. The interesting thing about that to me is the race against the clock to keep this stuff from overheating.
Yeah.
They completely punted on that, other than Woody Harrelson occasionally looking at it, and it was conveniently almost code red,
right.
but wasn't,
right.
and then use it for this nonsense MacGuffin that we don't care about.
Right.
They had something there. They had a lean from here to there movie about a cool space smuggler who beats the odds, but it could never just be that. It has to be this overstuffed emotion salad to hit every quadrant, both emotionally, thematically, and also globally.
Yeah.
And what you get is this film that I have to believe satisfies no one except people who are so eager to just hear that score again or see
what
Speeders
score?
Or whatever.
Like, what score are you talking about?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. And let's turn our talons towards something else here. Everyone was very excited to see Donald Glover as Lando Calrissian.
Mm-hmm.
I was very excited to see Donald Glover as Lando Calrissian. He appears to be getting an enormous pass for this film, which frankly, based on the strength of his other work and the brio that he brings to his performance, sure, he deserves it.
Mm-hmm.
He looks great in a cape. But I found his performance, or the performance, baffling because it seemed to me that he was still in the Lord and Miller movie, that he had somehow been grafted into this much more earnest movie. And so we have him basically doing bits about having a cape and having a spaceship and maybe being roguish.
And maybe having sex with a robot.
And the only character motivation you give him is that he likes to fuck robots, maybe? That's what you give him? That's what he has to do. He gets upset. He gets heated once, and that's when his
they
robot—
They toss out one thing in there about his mother.
Sure. By the way, definitely need more mommy and daddy issues in the Star Wars universe.
Yeah, but
great
that's
stuff.
Like, I accept that going through the door.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, that's on the ticket
yep.
to me. I didn't think that that necessarily had to be the case with the anthology movies. I thought the anthology
yes.
movies might be more like, you guys know, like everybody's got mommy and daddy issues, but they made that happen with Rogue One too, where Jin had to be doing everything because her mother was killed mm-hmm. and her father was taken from her. And
it's
everything
exhausting.
About that was this original emotional wound. And maybe that's what people think is the only thing that can possibly motivate anyone to do anything in this world. I don't know. I don't know why screenwriters choose to like make yeah. that the case. Here's the thing you were talking about with MacGuffins, if you don't mind me saying.
Please.
There's this very funny thing when like we're watching this movie and everybody's just like, Crimson Dawn. Ooh, Crimson yeah. Dawn. And I was just like, I don't know if this is from like Clone Wars or something,
yeah.
but I was like, what's so funny about Crimson Dawn to me? Why is that funny? And I was thinking back, I'm not sure if people have written about this, but like in Die Hard,
mm-hmm.
when Alan Rickman is making his list mm-hmm. of demands of like all his brothers and terrorist yeah. brothers he wants released, one of them is called Asian Dawn. And the dude next to him just goes, Asian Dawn. And he's just like, I read about them in Time magazine. That's how stupid this is.
Yep.
Alan Rickman's character in Die Hard is fucking laughing at this movie
yeah.
because he knows saying shit like Asian Dawn or yeah. Crimson Dawn is like nonsense.
How about—
Because Die Hard
yeah.
is a very simple, good story. Get out of the building.
How about the fact that they realized at some point that they needed something even more. They needed a Darth Vader at the end to make people ooh and ah their way to the exits. So they gerrymander in a villain who was sliced in half.
That I would say 70% of the people who are supposed to see this movie thought was dead.
And thought was dead 60 years ago
yeah.
or 50 years ago.
Yeah.
And instead, we have to learn, because we Google it, because we're content mining dum-dums, that, oh, actually, in the expanded cartoon universe, Darth Maul resurrected himself with robot legs. Get the fuck out. Bring me Alan Rickman instead. I want to come back to Alden Ehrenreich, who I
well, can
could,
I actually say
not
one
disagree
thing,
with you more
Because I want to say one thing that I think is actually the good movie.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
The good movie is The Great Train Robbery. The good movie is, that's a good sequence. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a great, it's a classic. First of all, it's like the first movie ever made.
Yeah.
Right? It's the, you know, and that is the perfect combination of dirty, rusty tech.
I like that.
And old West robber cops and, you know, mm-hmm. like cowboys and, you know, robbers. And they had a great sequence there. First of all, they score it way too much. There's just too much music in that scene. It's too chaotic mm-hmm. sounding. Second of all, the beat should be that it starts out with Han Solo joining this group of people,
mm-hmm.
right? And maybe he talks about Kira in the past or something, this girl that he left on Corellia mm-hmm. that he's never going to see again, but he has to get back to her. Mm-hmm. But you don't have to show the first 25 minutes of Lady Proxima and the orphanage and stealing the coaxium and all that stuff. He's with this group of bandits.
Yeah, so you start the movie
and
in the
rather
war.
Than give Tandy Newton and Jon Favreau's Rocket Raccoon imitation.
Is that who that was?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
That was Jon Hamm?
Favreau.
I thought you said Jon Hamm.
No. Can you imagine?
That would be cooler. Yeah. That was Jon Favreau.
Yeah.
Great.
rather than give them
John Favreau from Pods of
McBain
America
treatment, where they're just like
which John Favreau?
John Favreau, who's directing the Star Wars live action television show.
Oh, because Pfeiffer would have told us if it was the
other. But rather than give them 30 seconds of a McBain scene where they're just like, I couldn't wait to go back and learn the Valsichord and like, you know, I want to open a bar on Mos Eisley, you know, all that stuff. You could have drawn that out and made the train robbery the culmination essentially of a movie. Now, I know that they can't do that. I know that they can't say, here's a Star Wars movie where one set piece happens. I get that. But emotionally, you think about what would have happened when Tandy Newton sacrifices herself up there. That's such a bigger hit if you actually do the work to earn it. Instead, you jam her into this movie and introduce her and hit the ejector seat on her in 15 minutes.
Emotionally, it was inert for that reason. You're exactly right. If you either want to make a Dirty Dozen movie or like a, you know, The Sting, or you don't. And I think the truth is they want to, like we were saying about the Marvel movies often, they want to claim the mantle of better movies that they're stealing from and then just sort of give us all of them, but without any of the actual resonance of them. The way that that was structured is incredibly frustrating. But to me, the biggest emblem of the failure of the film is Dryden Voss.
Okay.
Now, from what I understand, from what I understand about this, in the Lord and Miller version of the film,
it was Michael K. Williams.
It was Michael K. fucking Williams.
Yeah.
Omar from The Wire. Of course, because Michael K. Williams is a prominent actor of color, he was going to be an all CGI character, much like who was it in Force Awakens?
Lupita Nyong'o.
Lupita Nyong'o. Right. That's a whole other issue that we should probably talk about on a separate podcast. Due to reshoots and due to his
scheduling,
he had to be replaced. So, okay, you're casting the role of a super gangster.
Mm-hmm.
You could cast anyone. You could cast creatively, man or woman, from any background, any age. It's Star Wars, man. It doesn't matter. And you cast The Vision? You cast Paul Bettany to basically swan in. And by the way, no shots to him because he seems to be enjoying himself. You cast a British Shakespearean actor doing the hammy British Shakespearean actor thing that has been the go-to villain of big budget sci-fi movies for 30 years. And okay, you put a little scarring on his face and one little funny fingernail.
Mm-hmm.
It's just lazy. It was shocking to me how lazy that was. Now, are you gonna cape up for Bettany?
No. I thought that Bettany, first of all of Bettany's scenes are shot in the same set, which I think is amazing because it's like you got Bettany for like 4 days.
Yep.
Like, make it count. And I think that Bettany tries his hardest in this movie, man. It's fine. He's doing a great Sam Rockwell impersonation. I'll say that much for him. And he's just in a different movie. This is what happens when shit like that. Like, this is what happens when they're like, we had to recast this part.
Yeah.
You know, we've shot this movie twice.
Mm-hmm.
We can't really do any Dryden stuff outside of this room.
Yep.
Like, do your worst. And he
delivers.
He hams it up. And the entire rest of the movie is not like that.
Nope.
Nobody else is in the, if anything, I you can feel three directors and all this pressure on that scene because they were like, we got Bettany. Bettany's going to do his thing. And it's like, we don't have any more time for him to do it again. Maybe that is or isn't true, but that's how it felt. And when he was just like, ah, Beckett, so good to see you, my friend. And it was just like, what fucking movie is this guy in? You know what I mean?
Like, he's like, there you are.
Han!
Tobias Beckett, a rogue of the universe.
You are going to get the coaxium, sir.
These are words I've said before and thought about for quite some time. You are all my good friends. You, Queera. No, sorry, Kira. Yes. Yes, my lover or slave. TBD, we'll fix it in post. I mean, you're right. The thing that we should say about Paul Bettany is that he arrives on set with the confidence of a man who has been in front of a green screen for the better part of the last decade.
Yes.
He knows that any choice he makes isn't really a committed choice.
Yes.
They can fix it.
It's not on the waterfront.
No, exactly. He's like, look around, my pleasure, yacht or spacecraft. Unclear.
Or Ford Tempo.
Here are jewels that represent the riches of the galaxy, or they are just mere glass baubles. I know not. Again, let me tattoo you, my slave wife. I'm sorry, line? It doesn't fucking matter, man. It doesn't matter. So, We gave them our $17, so they won. Let's go big picture, because I kind of want to go back to Alden Ehrenreich, who, Jesus Christ, I thought he was so bad.
I really thought he was pretty good.
I'm shocked.
I honestly did. It's not just because I've been like, I have a feeling he's going to be good. I actually thought, in a very strange way,
yeah,
at the end of the movie, I was like, I kind of can't imagine anybody else doing that.
Well, I think again, this is a larger indictment of film culture in general, that we just don't have Harrison Ford actors anymore.
Now, sure, yeah.
And I think that's been an interesting line of discussion out of this film, because for a long time we were saying, and I think one of the first pieces that Bill wrote for Grantland, or at least in 11 or 12, was, you know, what happened to movie stars?
Sure.
And he, like many people, are bemoaning the lack of, you know, Paul Newmans or Steve McQueens or whatever. Yes, we don't have those types, but it's kind of equally bad that we don't have Harrison Fords. People who are laconic and just comfortable in their bodies, who can then play in these worlds and bring to it a necessary sense of skepticism.
Mm-hmm.
I read somewhere online, and I apologize for not crediting it correctly, but someone was making the argument that I kind of can see, that Ehrenreich may have been cast perfectly for a Lord and Miller movie, because he seems like he's up for anything. And we do know from Hail Caesar that he has good comic timing. He seems to have a good sense of fun about himself and about performance.
I wouldn't necessarily say that his comedy is his strong suit.
No, but he seems to be up for stuff. And I think, sure, that they were saying that, like Channing Tatum in Lord and Miller's 21 Jump Street movies, which I ride for, he's fine. He would have been a fine knockaround avatar for whatever zaniness and, you know, giant space dragons they wanted to uncork. But in this, suddenly, you said they're not doing On the Waterfront. Some acting coach was telling him he was. And his emoting when he loses Kira.
I thought
Kira,
he was the biggest victim of the stuff that you're talking about, yeah, which is setting up this story salad where we don't trust an audience to either fill in some of the blank spaces or just do this in media res and let the screenplay show you who these people are. That he had to do. So everybody is like killing him for like when he gets through the gates and, mm-hmm, Kira gets stopped, and then he does all this acting next, mm-hmm, to a bunch of boxes, which is felt very much like an insert shot that they were
space
like,
boxes,
we need one more shot of him looking upset.
Because we're not sure how he feels.
Right. That was not fair to him, I thought.
No, but there's just, you just see the sweat. You see him working, and
I think we'd all be very surprised if we were like, any actor, here's what you have to do. Like, run there. There's a reason why movies are cut. You,
yes,
know what I mean?
Look,
like,
the deck was stacked against him.
Yeah.
And I'm saying the same thing for Glover, too. I just think that they were put or recut into a movie that neither of them thought they were performing in.
Sure.
But it does not do Ehrenreich any favors to be next to Woody Harrelson, who, playing, a total nonsense part, is effortless. He always has a good time in himself, in whatever situation he's in. I really enjoyed his own onset suggestion to be constantly eating space snacks. I really like the idea of a Brad Pitt in Ocean's 11,
sure,
just chowing his way through the galaxy.
Sure. It's probably because he also had the munchies, because he was high as shit the entire movie.
Yeah, I mean, wouldn't you have to be?
Yeah.
Let's talk about this in the larger framework. As
yeah,
you
okay,
suggested
so
at the
here
beginning.
Are a couple of the things that people have been saying as takeaways. One, you can't do a Star Wars movie 6 months after a Star Wars movie. I'm curious to know whether that winds up being proven out, because they definitely are developing enough content that, mm-hmm, that they are going to try and compete with Marvel in terms of both in terms of where they're putting, mm-hmm, the stuff on platforms, but in terms of the amount of movies they'd like to do. I mean, as soon as this movie was released with an announcement that James Mangold was going to make a Boba Fett movie.
Mm-hmm.
Now, plenty of Star Wars movies get sort of like kicked around a little bit. Josh Trank got fired off of the Boba Fett movie.
Mm-hmm.
We've got two different trilogies in development, plus, mm-hmm, the last Star Wars Force Awakens, mm-hmm, movie, plus a live action show.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that's happening here, I don't think that they're going to cut bait from anything because Han Solo didn't make enough money on its opening weekend. But I do think that there is an interesting point where it's coming at the end of this, not the end, but at the peak of this Marvel thing. So they think that's what you have to do. And they don't really think about, there were some really bad Marvel movies.
Mm-hmm.
There was Dark World.
Mm-hmm.
There was Iron Man 2 that nobody liked. There, mm-hmm, was like, you know, there was a bunch of movies. I like the, what was the first Captain America, the first Avenger.
Yeah.
I thought that was charming, but
I did too.
People looked at that as like, we didn't quite get that right. You, mm-hmm, know what I mean? it was only until maybe even Winter Soldier.
Winter Soldier is the inflection point, yeah.
Where they were like, ah, this is how we do it, mm-hmm. right?
That's correct.
Star Wars doesn't have that lead time. They can't make 3 or 4 or 5, 6 years of bad or mediocre or finding their way Star Wars movies. There's an expectation because right. they've got basically one of the most beloved pieces of culture in the last 100 years on their hands. And there isn't like, they're not playing with the margins that way. You know what I mean? Like the what they're investing in this movie reportedly cost $250 million after they got done shooting it twice.
Yeah.
And selling it.
And that's not marketing, yeah. probably. I think you're right. I think that
so that's the problem.
It is hard to have sympathy for people who are controlling, as you put it correctly, potentially the most beloved piece of intellectual property of the last century. Mm-hmm. However, it does come with burdensome expectations. I think what they thought they could do was mine two things simultaneously, neither of which is coaxium. A central spine of Skywalker movies mm-hmm. forever, and then play around in the margins and attract people because they realized they had the sandbox everybody wanted to play in, that they could attract people to make these smaller films. But what they are realizing, they cannot make Ant-Man.
No.
They cannot make Ant-Man and the Wasp.
Nope.
Marvel.
They can't make Ragnarok.
We used to.
Which is probably what this movie should have felt like.
Should have felt like. Exactly. I mean, I think you and I probably talked about Ant-Man when it came out as being weirdly inessential. And, you know, some people liked it more because of that. I thought it was fine. Only now am I realizing actually how important that franchise and what it represents is to Marvel.
Well, because
we just saw Infinity War and now they're bringing out this other movie that's going to be fun. And it doesn't feel like it's the same thing. Whereas, as you said, it's 6 months later, another earnest Star Wars movie about fathers and sons or family and obligations
same
beat, and
same
rebellion.
Same emotional beats, yeah.
That absolutely is fatiguing.
Yeah.
I think it's time. What I'm curious about is if anyone is going to have the conversation that maybe Kathleen Kennedy is not the person who should be in charge of this.
Okay, so the counterpoint to this would yes. be these movies are super fucking successful.
Well, that was what I was going to undercut my own yeah. argument. I wish it was not so. I know that diehard fans certainly agree with me more. Well, actually, I'm a diehard fan. Let me say, obsessed Star Wars fans, just to be clear. But these are hugely, hugely, hugely important widgets in the Walt Disney Company's stock portfolio. They need to make them to keep their shareholders happy now that they've been announced. And as you said, they have been incredibly profitable. They've been incredibly profitable in ways that we probably don't even appreciate. I don't have the spreadsheet data of how Force Awakens and Last Jedi did in China or these other marketplaces that are hugely important to the franchise, but I bet they did pretty well in comparison to other Disney movies there. They've hit their goals, and how ugly the business was behind it, that ultimately doesn't matter from a financial standpoint mm-hmm. as long as it makes its money back. But if you look at the series of truly bad decisions that have been made, and at what point do you stop being lauded for pulling out of tailspins and being criticized for putting them into the tailspins in the first place? That's what I want to know.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's the behind-the-scenes stuff that is their dark world and is their, you know, the failures, quote-unquote, are happening a little bit behind the scenes. And I think that, honestly, like, we don't really know. Like, mm-hmm. they very well could have had, a really bad version of Neighbors on their hands with Solo, and Ron Howard fixed and saved this movie.
Yeah.
And did some of the cast quotes and some of the stuff about what happened and, mm-hmm. and how it's changed over kind of suggest that may have been the case. You've seen in the past with these big franchises is that they all start out with the best intentions, and they all start out with, we want to be a home for really interesting filmmakers to mm-hmm. to have a voice mm-hmm. within this world and have the big tools in this sandbox. And then usually what happens is we wind up with David Yates or the Russo brothers mm-hmm. steering this thing back to port.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder whether or not we'll get more Ron Howards going forward.
I would think so. Now, let's just do the numbers.
And I thought that JJ coming back
yep.
suggests that might be the case.
Absolutely. I would say that hiring James Mangold to see if they can do a Logan in this universe, and James Mangold did Logan, that's why that decision
made sense.
Well,
Boba Fett, though, is something that I could see being, I don't know how much the lowest cost Star Wars movie can cost, but I would imagine they are like, realistically, nobody is going to see a Boba Fett movie except for people who have seen Star Wars like 100 times.
Unless they
lives.
Make a cool movie.
On yes, a, but even, okay, so this is a really good, people who don't care about Star Wars uh-huh. saw Force Awakens.
Yes.
And a lot of people who didn't care about Star Wars were convinced to go see Last Jedi. And a lot of people who care about Star Wars didn't like Last Jedi. So you've yes. got this like push and pull between, you've got to get the casual fans and you if hopefully get the casual fans to see it multiple times. Like I think a lot of people saw Black Panther. I was talking about this with Sean this weekend. Mm-hmm. A lot of people saw Black Panther multiple times mm-hmm. who had never heard of the character before the movie.
That's right.
Had never heard of any of the shit in that happens in Infinity War before the movie, but they were brought into a cultural moment.
And
you've got to create a cultural
and
moment.
And that's how you get from 500 million to a billion.
Exactly.
At the box office.
So a James Mangold Boba Fett movie should probably be aimed at like, if not content-wise, Sicario numbers. Like mm-hmm. it's a dark movie about a bounty hunter in space. We are not expecting children or yeah. you know casual Star Wars fans to love it.
Are they going to let them do that? Him do that? I mean, let's just run the numbers. Under the since Disney bought Lucasfilm and put Kathy Kennedy in charge of the franchise, they have essentially greenlit and or made six films. Force Awakens, Last Jedi, Untitled Episode 9, Rogue One, Solo, and Boba Fett.
Mm-hmm.
They have fired the directors either in production or just before production on four of the six.
Mm-hmm.
That's a super, super, super bad ratio. Now, I understand this is what franchise filmmaking is at this moment, but if you just think of the sunk cost, if you just think of the muddled creative vision that will come of that. I mean, there's almost no way to continually tank and then resurrect, tank and resurrect, or dare I say, trank and resurrect a film before you start losing track of which version you're making and it just becomes soup.
Huh.
I'm not advocating for people to lose their jobs, but it is interesting to think about the completely different conversations that are being had about this movie. And the reason why I think it's worth talking about the business angle of Solo is because often we're sitting here saying, this movie's a creative failure, but if it's a financial success, it doesn't matter. It's weird that suddenly the two conversations are more or less the same. This is disappointing creatively, critically, but it also is disappointing financially. So that does seem like the potential moment for a larger conversation to be had, or at least for the two conversations to become one.
Well, they're going to have 18 months to think about it, you know? And they'll have 18 months to, and you know, this was one that was a little bit different than Rogue One, because even though Rogue One, I think, had a lot of issues, they did a really good job explaining what Rogue One was about
yep.
and selling Rogue One. And Solo, you didn't get the 6 months in advance trailer, I don't think. You know, you didn't
no, because
get,
they didn't have one ready.
And they didn't have, you know, they just did not have, like, people have seen this and it's amazing, which is what was happening with Last Jedi and what was happening mm-hmm. with Black Panther in terms of that kind of word of mouth in advance. And I thought Rogue One did a really good job of being like, don't get your hopes up, but this is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I think that it has tons of problems. They were like, here's the probably most beloved character in the Star Wars universe. We hope we don't screw it up. That was the pitch.
Can you, before we move on, and I think we should wrap up, but I think people are going to come at us with love, I'm sure.
No, I think that there's mixed emotions about this movie.
But I think one thing that people will want to know is why we, or at least I know I did. You can feel free to push back on this, but basically unequivocally loved Infinity War and had trouble with this. I can articulate why, but I was curious if you had a particular take on why one succeeded and one didn't.
Well, I think Infinity War went the entirely opposite direction of what the Solo should have done. So I think that they had completely different jobs to do.
Agreed.
Infinity War, by its own sales pitch, is a huge ensemble that is basically looking for a couple of great bench minutes from all of the star players.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Nobody has to carry the load. I can't even remember who the quote-unquote star of Infinity War maybe is. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. it's not like it stayed with me and is haunting my dreams.
Mm-hmm.
Solo was probably supposed to... It should have been a one-hander. It should have been... Han has always been kind of on the periphery of this Skywalker thing.
Mm-hmm.
And here's a chance to find out what made him the way he is. And also to tell a cool cowboy, you know, a cowboy story... written as a 1950s like film noir with comedy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it probably should have been like a Coen Brothers movie, you know, and that they were never going to make that movie. But the reason why Solo is troubled is because it's getting pulled apart in all these different directions, mm-hmm. but it's supposed to be about one person and one story.
Yep.
Infinity War, that's not a bug. That's the feature, is to pull it apart in all these different directions.
I think that's well said. I would just add to that that—
And Infinity War, even though there are fake stakes at the end, at least has an endpoint and a denouement and a thing where you're everything's changed.
They made a choice.
Yeah, exactly.
Infinity War is, again, this is not the purest critical or creative advocacy I could ever do.
Oh, and let me just say, I also think almost every set piece in Solo is 100 times better than the Infinity War stuff.
Interesting.
Like, well, the inverse is true. Like, everything that's just people talking in Infinity War is 100 times better than Solo, and the train robbery and the Kessel Run are better than anything that's in Infinity War.
I don't think I agree with that, but I was just going to say that this might not be the most creative or the best creative or critical advocacy I'll ever do, but as a unified statement of purpose with intent from a giant corporation, Infinity War is about as good as you can do. I know that you referred to the Russo brothers a moment ago as able stewards, which I think they are, and Marcus and McFeely as the writers. They worked on it together, the four of them. Are they collectively William Goldman and Terrence Malick? No. But they are so well suited for this moment in this time that movie did feel not necessarily handmade, but human made.
Yeah.
That there were choices, the writing and the vision for it were in concert. I think, and we can leave it here, Solo is by no means the worst movie of this blockbuster era, this franchise era, or even of this decade. You know, I don't mean to make the stakes that high despite my enormous disappointment in it. But I do think that 10 years from now or 20 years from now or more, when people look back at different eras of filmmaking, different decades, I think people will hold this up as an exemplar of the worst of how we made things in this decade, just because of, look at what they did with it. Look at what it was. Look at these sort of half-baked robot revolution, and we have to fight to be ourselves, just trying to cram in people power politics, but by denuturing it completely. And the way that they inverted Han Solo from a crusty, he shot first mm-hmm. rebel, I mean that in the larger, like, James Dean sense, into just another young boy with daddy issues and a heart of gold. That's what it represents to me.
I don't think it's that bad, but I think it'll be forgotten, and that's probably worse.
Okay.
All right, we're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsor, and we'll be back to talk about the season finale of Killing Eve. Today's episode of The Watch is brought to you by SeatGeek. Buying tickets can be complicated and confusing, but there is a simpler way to buy with SeatGeek. SeatGeek is the smartest, easiest way to get tickets to every type of live event. Whether you're catching your favorite musician on tour, shopping for the perfect gift, or searching for a last-minute deal to see the Philadelphia Phillies!
I'm on a real SeatGeek run, my man.
Why don't you tell a personal anecdote about it?
I used SeatGeek to go see that incredible Paul Simon concert last week. Had great seats at the Bowl. Sightlines with my man.
I definitely wanted to hear all about it twice.
Do you want me to tell you the highlights of the set? And then last night, actually yesterday, on a whim, I used SeatGeek to take my girls to their first ever Dodger game, playing the first place Philadelphia Phillies. And we had great seats, great times.
Bullpen blew up.
Best thing about going to a baseball game with kids, you leave before the bullpen screws it all up.
Nothing beats being there in person, as Andy can attest, for the biggest plays of the year. And SeatGeek will get you closer to the action for a great value. SeatGeek is designed to make your ticket buying experience easier than ever. It saves you time and money by searching multiple ticket sites to compare prices and find amazing deals. And to get you the most bang for your buck, SeatGeek grades every ticket based on value to help you immediately identify the best seats that fit your budget. Plus, every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. Make SeatGeek your go-to app for finding the best deals of every type of ticket, from sports and concerts to comedy and theater. Best of all, our listeners get $20 off their first SeatGeek purchase. Just download the SeatGeek app and enter promo code WATCH today. That's the promo code WATCH for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. SeatGeek, right seat, right now, right from your phone. Today's episode of The Watch is brought to you by the big homies at Hotel Tonight. If you're the type that's always looking for a bigger, better deal, you've got to get the Hotel Tonight app. Hotel Tonight partners with awesome hotels to help them sell their unsold rooms, which means you get amazing deals. Their name is Hotel Tonight, but you can actually book in advance. You can book next week tonight or next month tonight. All it takes is 10 seconds, just three taps and a swipe. No long, endless lists. of a zillion hotel choices. Hotel Tonight only shows you the best deals at the best hotels. It's perfect for whether you're a planner or you like to leave things to the very last minute. And with Hotel Tonight's HT Perks program, the more you book, the better the deals get. Unlike other loyalty programs where you're trapped into staying at boring chain hotels. Here's the thing about Hotel Tonight. You can kind of plan out your staycations, your little mini vacations, your long-term vacations. It's the perfect way to kind of see what's out there. And sometimes I actually let Hotel Tonight tell me where to go. Like, I will say, like, you know, Memorial Day weekend, maybe I want to get away, see some ocean, but I'd love to not have to drive back. You know, I got a little day off. Mm-hmm. Use Hotel Tonight. Just go say, like, take me to the beach. So start scoring amazing deals at incredible hotels and download the Hotel Tonight app now. All right, Andy, we are back. We'll probably keep this a little bit on the brief side because we've talked about Killing Eve so much this season.
And we just spent, I don't know how much time, talking about another Phoebe Waller-Bridge passion project.
That's right. So the first season of Killing Eve came to a close on Sunday night. Mm-hmm. I think that this sort of confirmed, but also like softened any of the concerns that I had, which mm-hmm. was essentially like they have a successful show on their hands. Mm-hmm. I think that the season was written as it is. I don't think that they were like, you know, ooh, we got a hit on our hands. We got to extend this. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed the fact that the final episode allowed itself to be weird rather than do way too much work on the 12 and Carolyn. And
because every time they say the 12, I'm like,
yeah. Is this show is about two things. It's about obsession and it's about the way that love can make you crazy. Mm-hmm. And it's also about it's a spy show. It's like an espionage show. Mm-hmm. And those things are very interestingly smashed together with a tone that recalls everything from like early Tarantino. I mean, it's a very specifically like Phoebe Waller-Bridge's perspective. Mm-hmm. I thought that the very end of, you know, bloody sheets screaming, "I really liked you," is like the quintessential Phoebe
Waller-Bridge
moment. But I would say that the finale was one of my least favorite episodes of the season, but a lot of that may have been because the finale was like a little bit of a victory lap and a see you next year.
I totally agree with you. I think that I need to preface this by saying again, I think this is the best new show of the year. I think watching it has been full of true pleasure, true surprise, which sets it apart from almost anything else. I guess Barry would be, you know, in retrospect, an increasingly close second in a lot of ways. It's worth noting that there's been some reporting on the ratings of Killing Eve following a sort of sine curve that is incredibly rare in 2018. I think it's gone up like 900% or something ludicrous week to week. So this is
one growing. Of the biggest like word of mouth successes I've seen in a very long time.
And it's, as you said in previous weeks, this is only going to grow because this is not even counting the fact that a majority of added audience tends to come in the show's long tail and second life on streaming platforms or on demand or whatever as we wait for another season. I realize I did, like you, have a lot of nits to pick and criticisms of this finale. And I realize that's pretty much because the season for me has been about the show, I would argue successfully for the long term, readjusting itself from an AA+ to a BB+ and settling in. A to A+ shows can't maintain that tone or can't maintain that speed for multiple seasons, particularly when it is so focused on one single relationship. It just simply doesn't work. The analogy I found myself thinking of more and more after watching this finale was Homeland. Homeland, as has been argued by me, by you, by many people, if they had just ended it after one season with Brody doing what he did, the show is a legend. The show is forever a legend. Did good things come after that first season on the show?
Yes. And
multiple Emmy nominations and, you know, great long runs of performances by many good actors.
College tuitions paid for.
Well, certainly.
Yeah.
So it's almost impossible to argue that they made, it is impossible really to argue that they made the wrong decision. But looking back on what was the decision that they made? Well, they decided for the first few seasons, before then getting rid of Brody and settling into the procedural, maybe the show always should have been, was they went all in on the relationship. The second season, if you remember, had incredible highs and really, really low lows because it tossed out everything else and just zeroed in on the thing of the show that the creators identified as the thing that's made it exceptional. What I'm interested about in season two of Killing Eve is if they are more able to thread that needle than the creators of Homeland were, which is to say, make it broader by making it more of a procedural of, you know, they are both pawns in this larger machine of MI5, MI6, Russian intelligence, and the 12, whatever, while also maintaining this razor sharp focus on the couple, the central couple of the show. The season finale kind of tried to have it both ways, and I was a little bit out until that final scene, which brought me all the way back in, and as you said, reminded me of how this is Phoebe Waller-Bridge's
inimitable voice.
Yeah. I have concerns about her involvement. I don't know her schedule other than what I read in the trades, and it's quite busy.
Right.
We don't know how much of this show she can run, she can write, she can oversee in season two, three, four, five. Who knows how long this is going to go?
Yeah.
And I do think that will cost in the long run.
I would like to think that Jodie Comer is going to be a star.
Yeah.
Sandra Oh doesn't have any interest in probably ever doing like another like Time to Make the Donuts show again. Mm-hmm. And I think everybody involved probably is like very, very aware of how special a thing they've happened upon here. One thing that I thought was interesting over the course of the season, speaking of O, is for the first few episodes, Villanelle is the shark from Jaws. Mm-hmm. You kind of see the fin here and there, but you're not sure. It's a thing that's out in the sort of middle distance that the Eve character is using almost as a stand-in for her own midlife boredom. And it's like distracting her, you know, and then she gets pulled into this world by Carolyn, and it's everything she wants, and it's actually rewarding her for her possibly self-destructive impulses. And then as the second half of the season is essentially about Villanelle. I mean, we don't really see a whole lot of Eve's life, quote unquote, after that fight with Nico in the hall.
Yes.
I liked that because I think that Jodie Comer is just like a five-tool player, and I would watch her do anything. And it was just amazing to watch her over these last few weeks. But it is a different show.
Very different.
And it changed the tension of the show. And I thought that, you know, the kitchen meetup in the middle of the season is this extraordinary scene, and they had built up to it, and then there's this release from it. But then to pivot the show and make it really more about Villanelle's backstory, which I thought was fascinating, still kind of threw off the dynamic of what the original sort of perspective of the show was. And I thought that was an interesting choice. I'll be interested to see how they reconcile it in season two, whether they pull back and have it be more from Eve's perspective, or whether this is these two characters with two separate plots that are going to converge at some point.
I think that's really well articulated. I miss a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
When Eve says in the finale all of her own obsession, think about you, I almost had forgotten. You know, the show was ultimately not really interested in some of the things that we were hoping it would do more of. Spycraft, cat and mouse games. You know, if you remember, the show began with Villanelle as an assassin who is targeting people all over Europe, and they were trying to put the pieces together. Mm-hmm. It turned into a serial killer / single white female show based on obsession. And by the end of the show, Eve's tenacity, which Villanelle praises her for, is really just asking Kenny to do magic with the computers.
Sure.
You know, there really is no investigative
element
of the show.
And I like the fact that they conflate vengeance with desire and, you know, love and hatred at the same time, because those emotions can all feel very similar at various times. But it does get things a little muddled as to what we're doing, what the character really is doing.
This is the thing about TV shows and movies. Like Bill, the character from the beginning, it was a great and bold choice to handle him the way the show did.
Yeah.
I miss him. You know, I miss the presence that he had in the show. Kirby Howell Baptiste, maybe she had to go shoot Barry, unclear. You know, we haven't made enough of the fact that of the two serial killer shows that excelled in the first half of 2018, there was one
actress. Yeah, Lindsay wrote about that. She has a great piece.
Who was in both of them.
Yeah.
She's vanished from the second half of the season. Nico's vanished, another great performance and character. When she referred to having lost her husband, I was like, oh, are we sure about that? Mm-hmm. Like that's gone. A lot of those things that were working have been shed in it with a fearlessness that we've come to admire and respect in prestige television. But again, the show is settling in for a long run. And I wonder about those decisions knowing that now.
Mm-hmm.
Constantine, I'm less worried about. You can get over being gut shot. I'm sure he'll be back.
Yeah. I thought he was dead. Well, Carolyn says he's dead.
Carolyn says he's dead. I mean, I don't think you have a performance like that and you do it like that.
And they didn't really like linger on it that long.
And like the Anna suicide, I just think some of the decisions just didn't land emotionally in the end as I was hoping. But look, you get the scenes with Villanelle and the teenage daughter. I mean, it's the highs are so high and there's an electricity to this show that is next level.
You yeah. know,
that keeps us watching, that keeps us excited. It's funny, we had conversations about two completely different things, both starring Phoebe Waller-Bridge today, and we spent a lot of our conversation on both dissecting decision-making
mm-hmm.
and second-guessing or third-guessing process. And with the former, I think it was with an air of resignation and pessimism. And then with Killing Eve, I just wanted to say this to make it clear that this is exciting to be wondering about these things
sure.
in the case of Killing yeah. Eve. We want to see what trick they'll pull next because they've proven they can do it once. So it's exciting.
Let's see if Villanelle can make the Kessel run in less than 12 parsecs.
I think she could definitely outrun a space octopus.
We'll be back on Thursday. I'm sure we'll have plenty of stuff to talk about.
We're going
to
talk about the finale, the series finale of The Americans, because I have notes, I have a lot of thoughts, and unclear if we're going to have a special guest to talk about it with me.
Maybe like a nerf version of me.
My man, like you're just going to have to be like sedated slightly.
Okay.
Or we're going to give you some snacks. And I am just going to...
Maybe I can play FIFA with Zach Schwartz while you're talking.
Just clear the floor for me because we are going to talk, or I am going to talk about the series finale of The Americans
All right.
on Thursday.
We'll hit that. We'll hit other stuff. We'll be back on Thursday. Talk to you guys soon.
Buckle up, Baranskis.